Tell me who's that writing?
John the Revelator.
Tell me who's that writing?
John the Revelator.
Tell me who's that writing?
John the Revelator.
Wrote the book of the seven seals. John was on the island of Patmos. He heard a voice like a trumpet blowing. Write down everything what you see and hear. Send it out to the rest of the world and tell me who's that writing.
It's not hard to find predictions about the end of the world based on the Book of Revelation. So far, 100% of them have been wrong. And it makes me think maybe that's not the best way to interpret the Book of Revelation. In this edition of Religion Report, I talk with David Barr. David is a professor of religion at Wright State University and a specialist in the Book of Revelation. He's created a distinctive interpretation of the book by raising questions about the Book of Revelation as narrative. What kind of story is the Book of Revelation? If it isn't about the end of the world, what is Revelation about? Is it a healthy story or a dangerous one?
John the Revelator.
He wrote the book of the seven seals.
In the spring of 2011, we heard a lot about the end of the world, a loose alliance of ministries and radio stations predicted that May 21, 2011 would bring Judgment Day. May 21 came and went, and nothing apparently happened. One of the main spokesmen for this group was Harold Camping, a radio talk show host and Bible student based in the San Francisco Bay Area. And here's his explanation of what happened on May 21.
If people want me to apologize, I can apologize. Yes, I did not have all of that worked out as accurately as I should have, or I wish I could have had it. That doesn't bother me at all, because I'm not a genius, and I pray all the time for wisdom, and when I make an error, then I say, yes, I was wrong. I have said that already more than several times tonight. I was wrong. It was to be understood spiritually, not physically, and yet the sense of it is still the same, that judgment has come. The world is now under judgment where it was not prior to May 21. Spiritually, there's a big difference in the world that we can't detect at all with our eyes, but we can know from the Bible. We were convinced that on May 21, God would return here in a very physical way, that is, by bringing a great earthquake and by ushering in the final 5 months of the Day of Judgment. And the fact is, when we look at it spiritually, then we find he did come. He did come.
So he claimed that May 21 was actually a spiritual end of the world, and the real end of the world is coming October 21, 2011. Right now, as I record this, we're in between those times, and maybe it's a good opportunity to think about whether it makes sense to interpret the Book of Revelation in this way. The following interview is with David Barr, who is a professor of religion at Wright State University in Ohio. He's also department chair for philosophy, religion, and classics. He has a book out called Tales of the End, a narrative commentary on the Book of Revelation. And in my opinion, it's one of the best things to be written on the Book of Revelation in decades. David, it's good to talk to you again.
Thank you, Steve. It's good to be here in Texas.
Yeah, I'd like to start out by talking about the way you approach the Book of Revelation. When I talk to the general public, students in my classes, most of them have only heard of Revelation as a coded message for how history ends. But you don't approach it that way at all, do you?
Well, I used to. In fact...
How long ago?
Oh, probably 25 years ago. When I first came to Wright State, I wasn't much interested in the Book of Revelation. I was interested in the Gospels because they were stories about Jesus, and I was applying a form of criticism called narrative criticism, looking at how stories evolve, how they develop, how they're told from points of view and have interesting characters. And students kept bugging me to teach the Book of Revelation, which I had, as I say, very little interest in doing, because I had only heard and only considered that kind of interpretation that thinks it's talking about the end of the world. But after about 5 years of pestering, I am a patient man, I decided to give it a try. And when I got into it and started treating it with the same kinds of narrative concerns that I brought to the Gospels, it turned out to be quite an interesting story, a story that was relevant to people for whom it was written and continues to be relevant for people long after it was written, having nothing at all to do with the end of the world.
I'd like to unpack that word, that phrase, narrative criticism. First, the criticism part. Are you criticizing Revelation?
Yes, of course. A difference between reading poetry and thinking about poetry. When you want to read poetry, you just want to absorb the poem. But if you want to see how the poem works, you step back from it and you begin asking questions about it. How did this metaphor evolve? What's the author alluding to here? What the source of these words? And that's criticism. Criticism is stepping back from something and asking questions about it. So narrative criticism is what you do after you listen to a story. You hear the story, then you step back and say, well, how did that story work? Who's telling the story? To whom is it being told? Why is the author telling this story, and why is he telling it this way? Why does the character evolve in this direction? And when you ask those kinds of questions, then you're doing a narrative criticism of the story.
Is that a common method in biblical studies?
It is today. It developed about 20 years ago in biblical studies. Biblical studies used to be, for a long time, it was primary theological studies. They read the Bible to see what ideas were in it. And then a couple hundred years ago, people decided to look at the Bible historically, say, you know, what was it saying in the first century or the second century when these works were written? And historical concerns dominated what critics did. But then, I say, maybe 20, 25 years ago, some biblical critics began asking literary questions about how the work works. It wasn't well received at first. It was, I remember the first paper I wanted to do on this, I couldn't get accepted at the Society of Biblical Literature. I had
really?
To read it at the American Academy of Religion, which met at the same time and place as SBL.
How long ago was that?
I don't know exactly. Yeah, it would have been back probably in the late 70s.
Yeah. Back in the 80s when I was in grad school, I remember sort of, it was almost like a pitched battle between historical criticism and those people who do literary stuff. In literary stuff in derogatory terms.
Stuff being the key word there.
Yeah.
It was that way at first, but I would say by now it is pretty much accepted as a standard and probably, from my perspective, the most valuable tool that we bring to the text.
Do you still get hostility?
Not much. Interesting. I wrote an introduction to the New Testament back in the late 70s, and when they sent it out for review, the publisher sent it out to other scholars for review, they kept coming back and saying, you've got to talk about the theology of the New Testament. You can't talk about it as literature. And I convinced my editor that we were not going to do that. And by these days, nobody even raises the question. I mean, the manuscript sails through review. I'm doing my fourth revision of it currently. And nobody even thinks that this is somehow a strange way to do biblical studies.
When you treat the Bible as literature, when you use a literary approach, what do you think comes out of it that you don't get using other methods like historical or theological methods?
Well, one thing I think is the text comes alive in a way that it doesn't when you sit there and do historical criticism. I'm convinced that the nature of the biblical text changed for Western readers when we went to silent reading, that with the invention of printing and the multiplication of books and the books became individual things, not community things, For most of our history, the ancient world, medieval world, books were community property, and you would hear them in a group context. Somebody would read them out loud because most people couldn't read. And when a work is read out loud, you participate in it. It enters you, and you have a chance to respond to it immediately. When you read it silently on a page, you can stand back from it, and it becomes an object of study and not part of your experience. And one of the things that narrative criticism has allowed people to do is once again hear the biblical stories in something like their original key. Now, that says nothing about whether or not one believes the ideas in the story or whether you accept the presuppositions of the teller of the tale. Just like when you read a modern story, you hear it and you enter into it and it becomes part of you, but you don't necessarily believe in all the things that are found in the story.
Well, what about the Book of Revelation then? Do you imagine that as an oral text, or how do you reconstruct what was going on when this thing first circulated?
Well, we're fortunate there to have a very explicit statement by the author himself. At the beginning of the book, he says, "Blessed or happy is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy, and happy are those who hear and keep the words, keep what's written here, for the time is near." And so it doesn't take too much imagination to see here that the original setting is someone reading this book out loud before a group of people, and that the very hearing of it is the thing that is important. It's the one who hears these words is happy, not whether or not this is going to happen someday in the future. It's the entering into the story and letting the story transform the way you look at the world.
You remember several years ago, one of our colleagues did an oral presentation of the Book of Revelation, the entire thing with minimalist props.
Right, that was David Rhodes.
Yeah. Do you remember, hear that or
I did,
experience
yes.
it? What'd you think?
I thought it was an exciting experience. I had never heard a professional do the reading. I've often done the reading out loud with my classes where we each take parts and get together at night and read through the thing.
The whole thing?
Yeah. It only takes about an hour and 10 minutes.
You're a more dedicated teacher than I am.
To be sure. You hear that, Dean? But to hear a professional do it really did give you a sense of the story that the book is telling and of the author as a person. I came away with a much more vivid notion of who this author was. I didn't like him any better. In fact, I came away from that feeling that he was perhaps a little bit obnoxious as a character in the story, but more vivid than I did, and than it had ever been before.
So you don't like Revelation?
I do. I think it's a great story. I don't like some of the things it does, like vilifying one's enemies rather than talking to them, simply calling names to people that you disagree with, imagining that there are only two forces in the world, the good and the bad, and we're the good. All strike me as tenuous ideas that are found in this story. There are other good ideas found in the story, ideas about what it takes to stand up against evil, how you can respond to violence without yourself becoming a violent person, how you can make sense out of seeming defeat and reconstruct the world in your imagination in such a way that you can have the courage to do what needs to be done next and not, dwell on the past or that this may not come out well in the end.
If you look at Revelation using narrative criticism, then how does this text look to you? What kind of plot are we dealing with? What kind of story, characters?
Well, I see it as basically three stories in one common frame. It opens as if it were a letter and proceeds as if it were a vision. And then you have sort of three segments. In the first segment, the author encounters a human-like figure that tells him to write messages to these particular churches, and he proceeds to do that. And that's the first three chapters. When he's finished that, you might think the story was done. That's all that you've been set up for so far, that take a message, he took the message. But instead of the story ending, he looks up in the sky and he sees an open door and a command to come up. So he ascends to heaven and witnesses the scene of creation before the throne of God, sort of an idyllic dance of the universe around the origins of creation.
Here, so we're in about chapter 4 by now, right?
Right, we're in chapter 4 and 5. And at that point, he introduces the disruption that the scroll that needs to be read in this service is sealed, and no one can open it. And he cries because no one can open it. And then one of the characters in the story tells him that the lamb who has conquered can open it. Tells him that the lion of the tribe of Judah who has conquered can open it. But when he looks, instead of seeing a lion, he sees a lamb that's been slaughtered. And this lamb is somehow worthy to open the scroll. And that surely is shocking to the reader. If you expecting a lion powerful, forceful, taking what's right, making the world right. And what you see instead is a slain lamb, but the assertion that the lamb, through his own death, has made it possible to open the scroll. That is, there is power in that suffering. And that then unfolds a series of scenes that results in the reading of the scroll, which declares that the whole world is the kingdom of God and of his Messiah. And then, again, you could expect the end of the story there. The worship scene has closed.
How far are we into Revelation by now?
The end of chapter 11. And then at the end of 11, John sees the temple in heaven opened, and then a whole new series of scenes evolve this time. And now the story gets bloody. We get the dragon pursuing the woman, failing to capture the woman or her child, turns to make war on the rest of her offspring. And then we have these gory scenes of battles and destruction. This is the part of Revelation that most everybody remembers. If you ask people what's in Revelation, they only remember the last half from 12 on. They don't remember the first half. Almost everything that is in popular culture comes from that. The 666, the beast, the dragon, the final battle, Armageddon, all those things. Images that John takes over from the ancient stories of holy warfare, cosmic battles between the forces of good and the forces of evil, or the forces of order and the forces of chaos, and then transforms them in the same way he transformed the lion into the lamb. He transforms these battles into the assertion that the world has been changed by the coming of Jesus. I remember one of the first times I taught this course to undergraduates, making the point that what Revelation reveals, it is, after all, a revelation, is what it meant for Jesus to live and die. It's really talking about Jesus' life and death all the time. It's not talking about some future coming in far off. And this one student leaned back in his chair. We were sitting around a table. And he says, "You mean that's all there is?" And I says, "You know, that's exactly what they said about Jesus after his death." The story ends in a denouement with a new creation, a new heaven and a new earth, a new city of God, now come down into the world. Barbara Rossing makes the wonderful point that so much of those people who talk about Revelation as the end of the world talk about us leaving the world, being raptured out of it. But the whole movement of Revelation is the other way, that God comes down into the world and the kingdom of God is here in the world. It's not some place we go to. It's what we do to the world that we're already in.
You said, yeah, you talked about Revelation as three stories in one. You've got this, the chapters 1 to 3 that have to do with messages to the seven churches. You've got that worship, what you call the worship scroll in the middle, with chapters 4 to 11, and then the war scroll at the end. How does that all tie together for you? Or how do you see that? Is it one story? Is it three stories?
I think it's three overlapping stories, all talking about the same thing. What does it mean that Jesus is the leader of this movement? And on the one hand, we see him as instructing the community on how to live in the first story. We see him facilitating the true worship of God in the second story. And that closes with the scene about the world is God's kingdom. And it says, at that point, the narrator asked, "Well, do you wonder how that happened? Well, let me tell you another story. This is how it happened that the world was transformed." And that's the story of the battle between the dragon and the lamb that results in the victory of the lamb, although the apparent victory of the dragon.
I'm talking with David Barr from Wright State University about the book of Revelation. We'll be back in a minute to talk more about some of the imagery and the specific topics that come up when people try to make sense of the last book in the Christian Bible.
Standing midst the golden lampstands, tell me who's that writing?
John the Revelator.
Tell me who's that writing?
John the Revelator.
Now tell me who's that writing?
John the Revelator.
He wrote the book of the seven seals. His head and hair were white like wool, and bright as the new fallen snow. His face is shine like the noonday sun, and his feet were all aglow. You know his voice like a rushing water.
In the first part of this interview, we talked about the book of Revelation as a narrative, what it looks like as a story, and what it means to interpret Revelation as a story. I'd like to get back to the interview now and talk about some of the images and specific topics that come up when people work on the Book of Revelation. You've mentioned a couple of important images from Revelation. One of them is 666. How do you interpret that symbol operating out of a narrative critical perspective?
Basically, I see it as a symbol of that is characteristic of the number six. There are a limited number of quantity of numbers in the Book of Revelation, and they each have a specialized meaning. And the numbers are basically 3, 4, 7, 10, and then numbers that work off those, like 3.5 is a broken 7. And then there's this number 6, which is not picked up any other place in Revelation. But 6 is not 7. It's not yet there. It's incompletion. And I relate that back to the Genesis creation story, where on the sixth day, humanity is created. So the 6 is the human number. And that's pretty much what the text literally says. You could say a human number or the human number. Mm-hmm. It's the number of humanity. The text can be translated in different ways. That the beast of Revelation is not some external being that attacks us. It is we. As the old Pogo comic strip used to say, we have met the enemy and he is us. So I don't see it as a figure for some powerful human ruler or, you know, the Secretary General of the United Nations, as they imagine in the Left Behind books. It is a symbol for humanity insofar as humanity refuses to accept the limitations of the human condition.
You mentioned earlier the theme of violence and that this text undermines violence. I don't remember exactly how you put it, but that's a shocking statement for some people.
Well, that is perhaps one of the most troubling things about Revelation is the degree of violence that you see in some of these stories. War is a violent story, and the death of the Lamb is a violent story. I argue that the violence, if you look carefully in every place, that the violence is undermined, transformed, reversed by the way John deals with the images. The most obvious is the lion that you expect to exert power turns into a lamb who absorbs the power of the world and thereby is transformed and transforms the world by that. In the same way, in the final battle, the text literally says that the heavenly warrior, this is in chapter 19, slays all the followers of the beasts with the sword that he has in his mouth. And if he did it with a sword in his hand, I would say you have an image of violence. But a sword in his mouth is surely some sort of metaphor for his word, his testimony, his argumentation, that the world is transformed. Maybe this is just a college professor speaking, through the mouth and not through power.
Yeah, I could imagine somebody listening to this explanation say, well, that's awfully subtle. I mean, there's a lot of destruction and mayhem and catastrophe throughout this text. Doesn't that overwhelm this subtle little message about it maybe undercutting violence a little bit?
It apparently does, because most people read it the other way. I would say that the Book of Revelation is rarely read today except in small snippets. People do not sit and listen to the whole story. We are not near as good as listening at stories as the ancients were, who didn't have television or football games to go to, being at the University of Texas. And they were accustomed to listening to long stories and listening to them, I think, in subtle ways, in ways that perhaps escape us. Amos Wilder once said, just because we lack imagination, we shouldn't imagine that the ancients lacked imagination as well.
What are some of the other important themes that you think need to be emphasized from your narrative reading of Revelation?
Important themes in the telling of the story?
Yeah.
On the positive side, I think the overwhelming theme is a contemporary question of how do you respond to evil in the world without yourself being reduced to evil. I think we see in our present struggle with terrorism that all too often to beat terrorism we're willing to engage in the same kinds of tactics of torture, of deprivation of human rights, of transgressing our own constitution because it seems necessary. And one of the messages of Revelation is that if you do that, you really have joined the other team, and that you need to find a way to respond to evil in the world without imitating the evil itself, and that may involve suffering. Image I could never get out of my mind at this point is the Tiananmen Square image of the man who refuses to get out of the way of the tank that wants to come into the square, and he's willing to die for it. He wants to stop that tank, not with a bomb or Molotov cocktail, but by putting his life at risk for doing so. And it seems to me that the message of Revelation at some level, and how to work this out in a modern setting, I don't know. But I do think it's a story that calls us to work on that. On the negative side, the notion of imagining that there is a power of evil behind your enemies and that they are all evil and you are all good is a very dangerous way to approach the world. And I think that the story enacts that, but it also shows you the dangers of that way of approaching the world, I think.
You've been reading Revelation carefully for decades now. Has it affected you in over the course of time?
In some basic way, you mean, in terms of my own life? Not in any transformative sense, I think. I think it has drawn me into its world. It's taught me how to read about worlds that I don't naturally inhabit, you know, worlds of demons and monsters and supernatural creatures, and to be able to read those stories without pulling back from them. It's taught me how to enjoy a good story, but I don't think it's had any basic impact on the way I look at the world.
How do students react after you've worked on this for a semester with them, try to bring them along or show them other ways to look at Revelation? What kind of responses does it get?
Oh, quite a variety of responses. Some students resist, of course, and that's fun. It's good to have different readers in a story. Almost everyone expresses some appreciation for having been able to look at it in a different way, whether they followed or not. And I think without exception, when I've done an oral reading, students come up to me afterwards, and if they say anything, they say, I understand it now in a way I didn't understand it before. Even after all the class and all that, sitting here and reading through it from beginning to end, I have the sense that I understand the story, even if I can't make sense out of every individual part. Because that's one of the things that an oral reading does. It teaches you that you can't stop and look at something, because the story just keeps moving. You have to just accept it and move on to the next thing in the story. Let it wash through you.
Yeah. You think it's basically a good story?
It's a damn good story.
You think there's a future for Revelation?
Yes, I think there's a future for Revelation. I mean, one of the reasons why we have to study Revelation is that it's an important cultural text. It's a text embedded in our culture, often in very unhealthy ways. And I think we need to make available to people other ways of looking at this book and not just leave it to people who would use it in order to manipulate us for political gain, which is what I think happens to Revelation in popular culture. It's no coincidence, I think, that the people who wrote the Left Behind series are also very active in right-wing politics, that this notion of making people fear the future and expect a cataclysmic end to things is useful for controlling people politically. And one of the things we can do by teaching them to read Revelation as a good story is to disarm it from that kind of fear-mongering that goes on in our general culture.
Thanks a lot for taking time to talk with me, David.
It's been fun.
Yeah. This has been an interview with David Barr, who is an internationally renowned specialist in the Book of Revelation. He's a professor at Wright State University. I'm Steve Friesen. I teach at the University of Texas at Austin. And of course, the views expressed in this interview are those of the speakers, not necessarily those of the Department of Religious Studies or the University of Texas. Tony Ketty was in charge of editing and program development. Michael Heidenreich took care of post-production. The music comes from the CD, The Gospel According to Austin, Volume 1. The song is called John the Revelator, and it was performed by Johnny Nicholas.